The Bible study topic then, if you looked at the bulletin, is titled Death by Crucifixion. And I want to sort of build on the sermon that we did on the day Christ died. But what I'd like to cover in the Bible study may be a little bit different than a normal format, but I want to look at the scourging and the crucifixion that Jesus went through. And the article I have that I will share most with you is from the Journal of American Medical Association, I believe it is. But before I do that, I've got two nails here, and these are intended to be a close representation of what was used to crucify Christ. You know, we can't say that they are just like it or close or whatever, but from the research that I have read and found, the nails were probably 5 to 7 inches in length, and they were probably 3/8 inch square, and they had a little bit of a broad head on them. These are 8-inch nails, but I will pass those around. I'll do one on each side. If you would, just take and pass these nails back through and just run your fingers over them, and maybe it will help us in a way to see what Christ went through. Can I get a couple of you guys to just pass these out? Just start one on one side and one on the other. But just look at those nails. You know, it may be close to what was used, it may not be, but I don't think we would argue the point. I wouldn't want that driven through my wrist or my feet or anywhere. And again, this article that this information I'm going to share with you comes from is entitled The Physical Death of Jesus Christ. And it was in the journal The American Medical Association, came out in March of 1986. You can look this up on the internet, print this article off for yourself if you'd like, but it's also contained within one of the church's handouts from ABC, in one of the classes that they did on the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. But I just want to share this article with you today about the scourging and the crucifixion that Christ went through. And breaking into the story here, to kind of recap some of what we've heard already, but after Jesus and his disciples had observed the Passover meal in an upper room, they traveled to the Mount of Olives northeast of the city. And at nearby Gethsemane, Jesus, apparently knowing that the time of his death was near, suffered great mental anguish. And as described by the physician Luke, his sweat became like blood. And we read that account of Christ praying that his sweat became like blood. It says, although this is a very rare phenomenon, bloody sweat, as it can be called hematidrosis or hemohidrosis, may occur in highly emotional states or in persons with bleeding disorders. You know, and it's as a result of hemorrhage into the sweat glands, the skin becomes fragile and tender. You know, Luke's description supports this diagnosis that hematidrosis actually occurred. You know, there's differing opinions on that, but it seems to support that. And that the blood loss from this event was probably minimal. You know, in this cold night air there, it may have produced chills for Christ. You know, and part of this, too, in the research, the things, the articles that I've read is, you know, not only the actual scourging and the actual crucifixion that Christ went through, but, you know, all the mental and physical stuff he went through leading up to that. You know, being arrested in the middle of the night, you know, he was very tired emotionally and physically. So compound all of these things onto his state of being. You know, as we look more at the scourging and the crucifixion. And so he had had a pretty rough night. You know, and he knew things were going to be bad. But he, again, as we saw, it was his choice to do the Father's will. You know, and then he was arrested by the temple officials, and he was taken first to Annas and then to Caiaphas, the Jewish high priest for that year. And in the wee hours of the morning, he was tried before the political Sanhedrin and was found guilty of blasphemy. And then the guards blindfolded him. And this is when they would hit him, they would spit on him, you know, making fun of him. They struck him in the face with their fists. So they were mocking, abusing, and making fun of Christ. And he had been found guilty of blasphemy, which then was punishable by death. Thank you. So permission for an execution had to come from the governing Romans. Now, Jesus was taken early in the morning by the temple officials before Pontius Pilate. And he was presented not as a blasphemer before him, but rather as a self-appointed king that would undermine this Roman authority. And part of the reason for that is these high priests wanted to try and get the Romans where they were willing to have him crucified. You know, normally their affairs might not concern the Romans very much, but you know, they were trying, these high priests really wanted Christ to be put to death. They viewed him as a threat. You know, in their time, there would be people that would come along claiming to be a Messiah or claiming whatever, and they would be like a flash in the pan. You know, it would be short-lived and then it would go away. But this was different. You know, Christ had a following. You know, he wasn't going away. So they were getting concerned now. They had to do something to get rid of him. He was becoming a threat. So it says here a note on Jesus' health at that time. It said the rigors of his ministry, you know, traveling by foot, would have precluded any major physical illness or weak general condition. You know, it's reasonable to assume that he was in good physical condition before his walk to Gethsemane. But however, during these 12 hours between 9 p.m. and 9 a.m., he suffered great emotional stress, as we saw by the hematidrosis or the bloody sweat. He was abandoned by his closest friends and a physical beating after his first Jewish trial. And in the setting of a traumatic and sleepless night, he'd been forced to walk more than 2.5 miles to and from the sites of these various trials they were putting him through. These physical and emotional factors may have rendered Christ particularly vulnerable to these adverse homodynamic effects of the scourging that he was going to go through. Flogging was a legal preliminary to every Roman execution, and only women and Roman senators or soldiers, except in the case of desertion, were exempt from this. The usual instrument was a short whip, called a flagrum or a flagellum, with several single or braided leather thongs of variable lengths, in which small iron balls or sharp pieces of sheep bones were tied at intervals, and occasionally staves were also used. For scourging, the man was stripped of his clothing, and his hands were tied to an upright post. The back, the buttocks, and the legs were flogged either by two soldiers called lictors or by one who would alternate positions. And I guess by alternating positions, they made sure they got him from all different angles and got all of his back and legs and whatever was exposed. The severity of the scourging depended on the disposition of the lictors, what kind of mood they were in. And it was intended to weaken the victim to a state just short of collapse, just short of death. And after this scourging, the soldiers would often taunt their victims. And I read an excerpt here from this book that I didn't give all the details earlier, but I mentioned the scourging here in Rome was deadlier. The scourging of Rome was deadlier. And, you know, Jesus was likely standing, bent over a short column, tied to it securely, or tied to a post. And the tribune addressed the cohort and explained that the crime of this particular prisoner was that he had pretended to be the king of the Jews. And everybody broke out in laughter. Here's the king of the Jews. Now look at him. The callous soldiers knew that the king of the Jews was no one but Tiberius, their own king. Anyone presumptuous enough to try to usurp the place of Caesar was a fool indeed. It was the custom at times like this to permit these soldiers to enjoy some play with their prisoner, provided that the play did not kill the culprit. Several who had amusing ideas asked for permission to return back to their barracks, and it was granted. And this is probably when they went to get the robe they were going to put on him, you know, the staff and the crown of thorns that they made. The flagellum was brought all the way back and whistled forward and made a dull drum sound as the strips of leather smashed against the back of the rib cage. The bits of bone and chain curled around the right side of the body and raised small subcutaneous hemorrhages on the chest. A moan escaped the lips of Jesus, and he almost collapsed. The knees bent, then by effort they straightened. The soldiers murmured approval, because they had seen others who passed into unconsciousness before the punishment was fairly underway. The flagellum came back again, aimed slightly lower. It crashed against skin and flesh. The lips of Jesus seemed to be moving in prayer. The flagellum now moved in slow, heavy rhythm, one lash after the other. The men who watched made self-conscious witticisms about the fragility of the Jews and how unkinglike he looked now. The tribune was also watching, but he had a special motive. It was his responsibility to stop this discipline when he thought that the guilty one might not be revived. He stopped the executioner and he went over to examine Jesus. He didn't touch him. He bent close to see how much life was left. He could not judge by the tortured and bruised skin of the face. So he contented himself with watching the respiration of the rib cage. It was swift and shallow, and he ordered the executioner to stop. The scourging, according to this account, had not taken more than about 3 minutes. And I'd read varying accounts. Some say that usually it was 39 lashes they would get. I read one account, I don't know the accuracy of it, say that he could have gotten as many as 100. But this account here says it didn't take very long. And the gospel accounts don't record much of the details either. You know, maybe it was because it was so gruesome and devastating they didn't want to talk about it or write about it. But the executioner, with no more feelings of compassion than the priest had for the lamb when its head was through the ring, untied the wrist ropes, and Jesus at once fell off the pillar and rolled onto his back in the stones. He was unconscious, says here. The washing of the body was hardly an act of mercy. You know, they would send, it said in one case, they would send for, you know, a basin or basins of cold water, and they would throw that on the victim. You know, it wasn't to wash them off and to get them all cleaned up. It was to revive them back to consciousness so they could proceed with the rest of the execution. So in pretty terrible beating that they go through. And again, after the scourging, they usually taunted their victims. From a medical standpoint, as the Roman soldiers repeatedly struck the victim's back with full force, These iron balls would cause deep contusions, and the leather thongs and sheep bones would cut into the skin and subcutaneous tissues. Then as this flogging or scourging continued, these lacerations would tear into the underlying skeletal muscles and produce quivering ribbons of bleeding flesh. Pain and blood loss generally set the stage for the circulatory shock. The extent of blood loss during the scourging may well have determined how long this victim is going to survive once he's crucified. Jesus was severely whipped. And again, it's not discussed how severely, but it's implied that it was pretty severe. A detailed study of the Greek text for this verse in 1 Peter 2:24 indicates that the scourging was particularly harsh. Don't know how many lashes he got, whether it was 39. The Roman soldiers, amused that this weakened man had claimed to be a king, began to mock him. They put a robe on his shoulders, a crown of thorns on his head, and a wooden staff as a scepter in his right hand. And then they proceeded to spit on him and to strike him in the head, this crown of thorns, with the wooden staff. So that's driving these thorns into his scalp and into his head. And moreover, when they took the robe from his back, you can imagine what that would do to those scourging wounds. If it's been on there a while, it would sort of reopen those wounds after he's had this cloak or this thing around him. The severe scourging, with its intense pain and appreciable blood loss, most probably left Jesus in a pre-shock state. Moreover, hematidrosis had rendered his skin particularly tender. The physical and mental abuse meted out by the Jews and the Romans, as well as the lack of food, water, and sleep, could also contribute to the weakened state that he was in. Therefore, even before the actual crucifixion began, Jesus' physical condition was at least serious. And it was most probably critical. So he was in really, really bad shape even before he was crucified. The crucifixion probably first began among Persians. Alexander the Great introduced the practice to Egypt and Carthage, and then the Romans appear to have learned from that. They didn't invent it, but they perfected it as a form of torture and capital punishment that was designed to produce a slow death with maximum pain and suffering. It was one of the most disgraceful and cruel methods of execution, and it was usually reserved only for slaves, foreigners, and revolutionaries, and the vilest of criminals. Roman law usually protected Roman citizens from crucifixion, except if it was desertion by a soldier. But they would protect their own citizens from it. And it was designed, as we mentioned here, to inflict the maximum amount of pain and suffering that they could do and to prolong death. They wanted the death to last. They didn't want it to come quickly. When our society executes people and today, it's supposed to be humane and quick. But that's not what they wanted. They wanted slow and painful. There's some reports that victims could stay on there for a period of days before they died. And there's differing forms of it. It says some of the earliest forms, the victims may have actually been tied instead of nailed, or they may actually have been impaled on an upright post. But they wanted to keep the victim's feet off the ground, or keep it off of holy ground. And later on, it says that a true cross was used. And it's characterized by an upright post, which is called a stipe, and a horizontal crossbar called a patibulum. And it had several variations. It says a lot of times they would have these upright posts or these stipes would be a permanent fixture, you know, outside the city at the place of execution. This big post is in the ground. And then like this crossbar, this patibulum that, you know, the victim would carry with them, you know, they would carry that crossbar. And that could sometimes weigh from 75 to 125 pounds. So it's a pretty good chunk of wood they would have to carry. But there were several variations, and the archaeological and historical evidence strongly indicates that the low tau, T-A-U cross, was the one that the Romans preferred to use at the time of Christ. Crucifixion practices often varied from region to region, and in accordance with the imagination of the executioners. You know, so there's been several forms that have been used over the years. But it was customary for the condemned man to carry his own cross or his own crossbar, the patibulum, from the flogging or the scourging post to the site of the crucifixion. So here they shred his back, neck, arms, whatever's exposed, and then they put this crossbar, this patibulum, on his shoulders to carry. And he was usually naked, unless it was prohibited by local customs. And it says again, the weight of this patibulum, this crossbar, was likely 75 to 125 pounds, placed across their neck and balancing on both shoulders. Usually, their outstretched arms were tied to this crossbar. And this processional to the site of crucifixion was led by a Roman military guard. And one of the soldiers would carry a sign on which this condemned man's name was written and the crime that he was guilty of or accused of. And then they would put this sign above the victim, you know, so that everybody walking by could see, what did this guy do to deserve this? And outside the city walls, and were permanently located these heavy wooden upright posts on which this patibulum would be secured. And in the case of the lower version of this, it was accomplished by means of mortise and tenon joints and with or without reinforcements of ropes. And sometimes it says to prolong this process, they would put a wooden block or a plank kind of as a crude seat so this victim could get some relief from their struggle. And at the site of the execution, by law, the victim was given this bitter drink of wine mixed with myrrh and a mild analgesic, you know, to try and deaden a little bit of the pain. And then it says they were thrown to the ground on their back with their arms outstretched on this crossbar. So they've been scourged and now they're thrown back on the ground on their back. So that's going to aggravate all that wound again. And at this point, the hands could be nailed or tied to the crossbar, but nailing was usually the preferred method. And these nails, again, I mentioned earlier, there were tapered iron spikes approximately 5 to 7 inches long and with a square shaft. And so it's something similar to what I've got here, maybe a little bit different in makeup, but quite painful nonetheless. After both arms were fixed to the crossbar, the patibulum, the crossbar, and the victim were lifted onto the stipes. And if this were the low version of that cross, probably 4 soldiers could have lifted this victim up and placed him on top of the post pretty easily. But if it was a lot taller version of this, it said they may have to climb a ladder or use some kind of wooden extension forks to do it, but most of the time, they were trying to get these victims down low, not very far off the ground. Because another part of this process was the humiliation aspect. They wanted that victim to be down down low enough that the people walking by could look at their eyes and could see the victim. You know, see them there. You know, so they weren't likely way up high out of sight. They wanted to get them down, you know, where people could really see, you know, really humiliating. And after this, the feet were fixed to the cross, or fixed to the stipe, the upright post, by nails. And then when nailing was completed, they would put the sign up above the victim's head. And then the soldiers and all the people that were watching this would start to taunt and jeer the condemned person, make fun of them. And the soldiers would then customarily divide up this person's garments. And a lot of times they would do this, they would crucify these people with no clothes on. And sometimes they would allow at least a loincloth, but again, to achieve the humiliation factor they were after, it would be totally exposed. And, you know, and if they, there's lots of other details you can read about that, but it was really humiliating for this victim. You know, and then there, the soldiers, the crowd around them, mocking, making fun of the condemned person. And the length of this survival generally ranged from 3 or 4 hours to 3 or 4 days. And that could also depend on how severely they were scourged. You know, even if the scourging had been relatively mild, these Roman soldiers could hasten the death by breaking the legs. And this was called crura fragrum or crura fraction. But anyway, they would break the legs, because what's happening is, you know, when the victim is there, and their hands would not be usually done really tight either. There would be some play or slack, if you will, so that the victim could slump down. And as they're doing that, it starts to compress on their chest and they start to suffocate. And so then they would muster up some strength to push up off those feet that are nailed. You know, push up just enough to catch a breath or to get rid of the breath they'd taken in, and then they would go back down again. You know, so it's this constant battle of pushing up on that nail through the feet, and then they'd slump back down, you know, and usually the nails were driven probably through the wrist, you know, rather than the hand. The research and studies have been done that the palm of the hand could not support the weight. It would probably just tear out. But all the evidence seems to show that they would put a nail right through the wrist here, through some of these, the couple of bones there. And then it says, not uncommonly, insects would be an issue with open wounds or the eyes, ears, and nose of the dying and helpless victim. Yeah, so, and they could do nothing about it. Yeah. No one was intended to survive crucifixion, so the body was not released to the family until the soldiers were sure that the victim was dead. And by custom, one of the Roman guards would pierce the body with a sword or lance, just to make sure that somebody didn't fake their death. But traditionally, you know, it's considered to be a spear or sword to the person's heart to make sure they were dead. So the scourging prior to crucifixion served to weaken the condemned man, and if blood loss was considerable, to produce orthostatic hypertension and even hypovolemic shock. And when the victim was thrown to the ground on his back in preparation for transfixion of his hands, these scourging wounds would likely become torn open again and contaminated with dirt. Furthermore, each respiration that they take while they're crucified would cause these painful scourging wounds to be scraped along the wood of the stipe that they're on. So as they're taking these breaths, as they're moving up and down to get relief so they can breathe in or breathe out, they're rubbing these wounds up and down the the wood of the stack. And as a result, blood loss is probably going to continue from these wounds throughout the crucifixion. And accordingly, these iron spikes or nails that were driven into the wrist were driven between the radius and the carpals, or between the two rows of carpal bones. You know, either proximal to or through the strong band-like flexor retinaculum and the various intercarpal ligaments. So if you can imagine that just being driven through all of what's inside the wrist. Although a nail in either location in the wrist might pass between these bony elements and produce no fractures of a bone, the likelihood of painful periosteal injury would seem great. The driven nail would crush or sever the large, rather sensorimotor median nerve. The stimulated nerve would produce excruciating bolts of fiery pain in both arms. And although the severed median nerve would result in paralysis of a portion of the hand, ischemic contractures, impalement of various ligaments by the iron spike might produce a claw-like grasp in the victim. You know, when they drove that nail or spike through there, you can imagine this pain that they're going to experience when that's occurring. And most commonly, the feet were fixed to the front of the stipes by means of an iron spike driven through the first or second intermetatarsal space. It's likely that the deep peroneal nerve and branches of the medial and lateral plantar nerves would have been injured by the nails. And the scourging would produce sometimes considerable blood loss. But crucifixion, per se, would have relatively minimal blood loss the way it was done, since no major arteries likely were punctured with these. But we can see from some of that, again, it just reiterates that what Jesus Christ went through was extremely painful and excruciating. And He willingly did that. He accepted that. The crucifixion, this type of death was reserved for the worst criminals. It was intended to produce the maximum amount of pain and suffering that it could cause to the victim. And it's to really humiliate them. And Christ lasted about 6 hours on that. And we notice too that with the high Sabbath approaching, they were going to do the crucifracture, breaking the legs of the victims. And that's kind of an irony of the whole deal here. They're following and observing all these customs. We don't want to do anything to interfere with the Sabbath that's coming up. But yet, look what they had done to Jesus Christ. But they ended up, Jesus was already dead, but they were breaking the legs of the two criminals crucified with Him to speed along their death. I hope this wasn't too gruesome or gory, but a lot of times when we read through the gospel accounts of it, there's not a lot of details on what Christ actually went through. We know He was scourged and He was crucified, but when we really understand these practices and what they did and why they did them, again, it should reinforce our appreciation. And an understanding of this should reinforce our appreciation of just how magnificent that sacrifice is that Christ did for us and what He willingly went through for us. And to go through this type of death that was reserved for the lowest of the criminals, the worst of the criminals. You know, the pain and suffering that he went through. And he went through that for all of us. So I hope gives us a little bit more understanding and maybe more of an appreciation for what Christ went through for us. Thank you all for